But come Monday, back in the City of Angels, right there in Los Angeles. When we come right back, it'll be Dr. Michael Sala on Coast to Coast AM. And we're back with Dr. Michael Sala. Michael, you said about 60 different ET races may be coming to this planet. 60 of them?
Well, that's correct. I mean, those are some of the estimates. I mean, that estimate came from Clifford Stone, who worked for 22 years in the Army, and he claims that he was part of a elite crash retrieval team, and he was given a guidebook as part of his job, and in that guidebook it had listed a specific number of extraterrestrial races in terms of their medical requirements in case he ever came across any of these, and it had almost 60. And there have been other estimates as well, as much as 200 I have seen. I don't know how accurate that number is. I mean, that's from the Robert Collins book, Exempt from Disclosure, where they have 200 extraterrestrial races. But clearly we have many different races visiting us, that means that we need to consider that they're going to have different technologies, they're going to have different agendas, different motivations, and they're going to interact with people very differently. So this is an incredibly complex phenomenon, and it means that we can't generalize about it, that they're not all bad, they're not all good. I mean, that we're really looking at a spectrum of motivations and agendas for extraterrestrials.
Well, you know, and they could be robots, they could be androids, they could be time travelers, they could be coming through other parallel universes. Who knows where they're coming from, Michael?
Well, that's right, George. I mean, we really are just really scratching the surface here when it comes to this whole phenomenon. I mean, we're trying to piece together a puzzle given the very limited testimony we have from a number of whistleblowers and abductees, contactees, people who have had some kind of physical interaction. But I do believe that this information is very well known amongst those who have the clearance to get access to this information. For example, Clifford Stone referred to a school that was reserved for people who had the right clearance, who could go in and learn all of this material about how many races there are, what they're doing, their motivations. And but he says he chose not to attend that school for some reasons to do with the way it changed people.
Now let's talk about the space weaponry first of all. Now, are we talking about weapons on this planet that can shoot into space, or are we talking about weapons that are circling the planet right now that we launched?
Well, we have to consider both. I mean, first of all, when it comes to weapon systems that we don't know too much about, weapon systems like HAARP, that is located in Alaska and presumably in other locations such as Arecibo in Puerto Rico, that mechanism is able to activate the ionosphere in ways where you can have very high discharges of plasma gases that would shoot off in all directions. So that would basically form a particle beam weapon in outer space. Now, a lot of the people who do the research on HAARP, they always consider it in terms of, well, what does it mean in terms of the population on Earth and different territories? I mean, that's what they're looking at. Like, for example, Nick Begich, who I've met and is an excellent researcher, in his book, Angels Don't Play This HAARP, I mean, that's really what he's looking at, is how the HAARP system is going to affect the surface area of the planet in terms of the population, in terms of the land, in terms of how planes or other devices are operating in the atmosphere, or ballistic missiles possibly. But the real question is, well, what does HAARP do when it is used to generate these discharges, these ionic discharges in the ionosphere, if there are vehicles in that vicinity? So, for example, if they wanted to disrupt the electrical systems of satellites or UFOs, ET ships, they could use the HAARP to do that, and it would form an excellent particle beam weapon. Now, of course, this is a covert operation because officially HAARP is just performing some kind of benign research of the upper atmosphere and the aurora. That's the weapon system. Those sorts of weapon systems we're not sure about, but we can speculate given the patents that exist, the disclosures of experts, the sort of thing that Nick Begich has been doing for a number of years, which is excellent work. But there has been the public...
Are you there, Michael?
Yes, there's been the publication of a very important book by Douglas Beeson, and it's called The E-Bomb. And it outlines the development of directed energy weapons over the last 40 years or so. And this basically outlines space weapons or weapons that can be used as space weapons that are kind of white projects that we know about. So these are things that can be deployed from the ground or actually placed in space as well and can be used against targets, whether it's satellites, whether it's extraterrestrial vehicles. That's another category. And of course, there's always the possibility of nuclear weapons being up in space in terms of certain satellites having nuclear detonators or nuclear devices on them that could be used as a kind of space weapon as well. So we need to consider those as well. But, of course, that's not the sort of weapon that's going to be kind of admitted openly. So, but certainly the potential is there for that kind of weaponry to exist.
Do we know if our astronauts ever had any weaponry up there and if they ever fired it, if they had it?
I haven't come across that in terms of NASA missions, that the astronauts had that kind of weaponry. I mean, the way I understand this whole phenomenon, the way in which it's been successfully managed, is that you actually have a kind of parallel system. They have a parallel military system that has all this technology and that deploys it and can very easily have a number of manned vehicles out in space that can actually deploy advanced weapon systems such as lasers or even nuclear detonators. Now, there's a very real possibility that can exist as a parallel system. But as far as NASA is concerned and as far as the conventional military is concerned, the NASA missions have not performed that kind of military function. That there haven't been any weapon systems deployed on there as far as I know. There have been too many astronauts who have come forward to talk about what has happened. And if they did have a weapon system up there, I don't think they would have talked about it. I think that would have leaked in some way, but that hasn't happened. So I don't think they do play a role in the use or deployment of weapons in space.
Well, you don't know if these weapons are indeed real. We are light years ahead of everybody else. And to me, what are we so concerned about other nations getting conventional weaponry when we might have these things, Michael?
Well, I think the real question here is exactly what is it that is of concern in terms of other nations getting more sophisticated weapon systems. I think there is a very real concern that as we have more sophisticated computer systems coming online, the kind of computing systems that are available today are just so much more powerful than the computing systems that were used, say, 10, 20 years ago to develop the modern conventional arsenal that the U.S. has. So I think with the current technology that exists in terms of computers and that are freely available, supercomputers and so forth, I think that many nations now have the capability to develop advanced weapon systems. And some of those weapon systems would be the sort of things that might not be publicly available. For example, in 1997, the Secretary of Defense at the time, Secretary of Defense Cohen, he talked about weapon systems that could cause earthquakes and volcanic eruptions and seismic activities, and that this was something that terrorists could deploy. So this is a Secretary of Defense, William Cohen, back in 1997, talking about this. So I think there was the understanding, or there is the understanding, that these kinds of sophisticated technologies that could be used as weapons can be developed by many nations. And I think this is part of the rationale for why the U.S. is so intent on bringing the rogue nations into conformity with international norms, because I think they understand that the North Koreas and the Irans of this world, that if these states aren't brought into conformity, if somehow they develop some of these weapon systems, we can have disaster, because I mean, they don't, those nations aren't really behaving in a responsible way. I mean, they can be very reckless, and they have short-term kind of agendas, and that can be very dangerous. So I think that's probably why they are very concerned about the conventional weapon systems of Iran and of North Korea.
Are you aware of a website and a bizarre story called Serpo, S-E-R-P-O?
Yes, I certainly am. I actually have a paper that I released on my website, the exopolitics.org website, where I talk a bit about the Serpo information.
What do you think of this, Michael?
Well, I think if we look at the main characters, I mean, there have been three people who have actually come forward and said that they have actually witnessed Serpo material in classified documents that they had access to. Now, one of those is Richard Doty, who was a former Air Force Office of Special Investigations, a special agent, and he was basically in charge of, he was playing a role in various disinformation strategies and deception programs that the Air Force Office of Special Investigations was conducting. There are two others who have also come forward who have worked for the Defense Intelligence Agency, who have said that they came across documents while they were in those positions. And one is, his surname is Lakes. And the third one, his name escapes me at the moment, he also has worked with the Defense Intelligence Agency. Then the ultimate source of this information is coming also from people within the Defense Intelligence Agency. So what that suggests to me is that Project Serpo is either a very elaborate, officially sanctioned acclimation program to basically get people ready for the truth,
mm-hmm.
or it's a deception program to basically muddy the waters so that we don't know what's really happening, because people are so confused and arguing over what's real and what's not real, because that's the way in which a deception program would work. You would muddy the waters. You would put out a truth and kind of surround it with layers of disinformation that keep people confused and arguing.
Well, it's an incredible story of basically an exchange of astronauts for ETs as we went and visited them on their own lands, their own planet. Incredible story. I mean, far-fetched? Yeah, it sounds that way, but you never know anymore, Michael.
Well, this is, I think, what a lot of people kind of intuitively grasp, that there's a truth there. And most people, like myself, will say, well, we do know that Reagan did speak to Steven Spielberg after watching Close Encounters of the Third Time, and he'd say, you know, there's only half a dozen people in the room who would know how true that movie really is. So immediately you think about, well, what did the Close Encounters of the Third Kind depict? And it depicted at the very end 12 military personnel going into the ship and being taken off planet. So there you have an exchange program.
Well,
so,
I got to tell you, I know the late president's son, Michael Reagan, and I asked him one day, I said, Michael, did your father ever talk about extraterrestrials? And he said, well, a couple things. He said, one, he was a believer, and he believes he also saw one near his ranch in California at the time. But he did not elaborate or say anything about the Star Wars defense system or anything like that. But he did believe in extraterrestrials, and that, I think, was pretty important.
Well, that's right. I think he definitely had information. He was briefed to some level. He knew about this. And I think that's what he disclosed to Steven Spielberg, that he was saying that, yes, I know about this, that this is real. What you have in this movie actually fits the facts as I've been briefed. And I think that's really what the Serpo material gets most of its strength from, that the core story of an alien exchange program is, I would say, probably based in fact that it did happen. But I think a lot of the other material that's associated with it in terms of flight logs and what actually occurred when this group of 12 reached the planet Serpo, I think all of that is fiction. I think that's really just contrived. So it really does take a little bit of sifting through the material and sorting out the wheat from the chaff.
In your opinion, based on the work you've done, do you think we have a space weaponry program going on right now to shoot down extraterrestrial craft?
Definitely. I think that is happening for some time, the number of extraterrestrial vehicles that have crashed on the planet suggests that we have been actively experimenting with different technologies, whether it's advanced radar, whether it's nuclear detonations, whether it's the HAARP system, whether it's laser weapons that, and possibly other exotic weapon systems that we still don't know about, that through a combination of all these weapons being deployed and tested, that we, and here I'm talking about the military, have been targeting extraterrestrial vehicles and shooting them down. Ryan Wood published the book very recently, a 2005 book called Magic Eyes Only, and he goes through in that book 74 cases of crash retrievals of UFOs that had been retrieved after they had crashed. And so we can assume from that there are a lot of these vehicles that are crashing. Now, why are they crashing? Is it just because, you know, after traveling across the galaxy that somehow the Earth's magnetic field is so unstable that somehow they crash? Maybe a few of them do crash that way. But I think for that kind of number, we're probably looking at a lot of those being brought down through some kind of military technology. So I think that we are deploying space weapons to shoot down extraterrestrials, and military personnel like Philip Corso was strongly supportive of that. And we need to be aware of this. And as Paul Hallier said, we need to make it a policy issue. We need to say, well, this is something we need to debate. Why is this happening? And why are they shooting them down? And what's going on to make this so real, so that this issue is brought into the general public so people can begin to debate it? Because we don't want our world to be dragged into a war that can be devastating for reasons that are forever kept from the general public.
I got to tell you, if I was in charge of the ET Armada and, some earthling shot down one of my craft, I would take half the planet apart. I wonder why that hasn't happened yet.
Well, this is the thing. We have heard of cases where, for example, in Cuba, and I forget the exact date, but where some Cuban MiG fighters were trying to intercept some UFOs and actually fired their missiles at the UFOs, and those MiG fighters were taken out. They were destroyed. So the UFOs can actually retaliate. We also know the case of the Iran jets, or the F-4 jets in 1976, I believe, that intercepted some UFOs. I mean, they tried to do a radar lock-on with their missiles, and their electronic systems went dead. And it was only when they turned around that the electronic systems came back. So I think that the ETs have technologies to be able to respond to attacks, but obviously sometimes they are targeted successfully and are brought down. And what weapon systems do it, we're not quite sure. But I certainly would say that it is happening. And this was one of the things that Clifford Stone, who I spoke to about this particular problem, he did say that, yes, the UFOs were being targeted and being brought down by advanced weaponry.
Let's talk more about the former Canadian Defense Minister, Paul Hellyer, when we come back, because like Corso, here's another major government official, this time the Canadian, who has come forward to say he believes that space weaponry is being used to fight extraterrestrials. It's an incredible story. Back with Dr. Michael Sala in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. A neat graphic created by Dale of the Fantastic Forum in honor of Spike Mike, their moderator's fifth anniversary there. Go take a look at it under listeners' emails on the coasttocoastam.com website. When we come back, we'll continue chatting with Michael Sala, and next hour, we'll open up the phone lines to give you an opportunity to chat with him as well. We'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, it appears to me that the former Canadian Prime Defense Minister, Paul Hellyer, that this story and the fact that he's come public may be one of the biggest in UFO history since Corso, primarily because, I mean, it's tantamount to Donald Rumsfeld coming forward saying there are ETs and this is what we've been doing. It's a major story. Why hasn't it really received the kind of press that it should?
Well, there has been quite a bit of press coverage in Canada, as you would expect. I mean, the Canadians know Paul Hellyer as a former defense minister, and they take him seriously as someone with a lot of credibility, even though for many Canadians, probably the UFO issue is something that they're still not very familiar with. With the US, I mean, it's a lot more work, and I think that the ridicule factor is still there. But nevertheless, he still has been interviewed on a number of shows like MSNBC and Fox Network and a number of other American broadcasting networks.
But do they take him seriously, Michael?
I think they kind of take the whole issue as something that's kind of a little incredible, but yet almost eccentric. I think they take the approach, well, you know, here's someone who has held a senior position at some point in his life as a defense minister, and now he has these views about UFOs that, you know, this is probably someone who's quite eccentric. And so they probably make fun of it in that way. But on the other hand, they do interview him, and he comes across as very credible and very balanced and someone who has a firm grasp on the policy issues here, and he wants to bring those policy issues to the fore to debate them. So I think he does impress the viewers, and that's probably where it really is such a great benefit to have someone like Paul Hellyer come forward, because he carries a lot of credibility, and he's also a very skillful politician. I mean, he's been around for a long time. He knows how to deal with the media. He knows how to deal with people who might be dismissive. And so you can see that he has a lot of experience and he handles himself well. And I bet that many of those interviewers who probably start off thinking, well, he's an eccentric Canadian liberal who's going to tell us about UFOs, and probably end thinking, well, you know, he may be onto something here. And I think that's progress.
I sure wish his sources would come forward and say something. Why, in this era, here we are, 2006, do we still have whistleblowers who don't disclose who they are?
Well, there's still a lot of fear amongst whistleblowers. I mean, this is one of the things that UFO researchers themselves have a lot of difficulty grasping, is that many whistleblowers live with a very real threat in terms of just how much they disclose. If they disclose too much, they can be taken off the scene. And I want to raise one name here, John Maynard, who was a former Defense Intelligence Agency analyst. He did come forward. He was part of the Disclosure Project with Stephen Greer. He came forward, and he disclosed a little too much, apparently. And he was threatened a few times, incarcerated, let out. And then he kept on disclosing, and in 2003 he disappeared, and we believe that he disappeared because he just basically said too much. And that just gives you an idea of the kind of risk that many of these whistleblowers take in terms of disclosing this kind of information. So for that general that told Paul Hellyer that Corso is the real deal, the general realized that, well, as long as he didn't confirm who he was, It would be okay. He wouldn't be in danger. But if he came forward and said who he was, what his rank was, and people suddenly wanted to interview him, that then he would be taking a risk. And probably that is why he has decided not to come forward. I mean, it would be great if he did come forward, but I guess that's something he has to decide, and Paul Hellyer is just maintaining confidentiality.
What's going on, Michael, with Dr. Stephen Greer? I had him on the program some time ago. He seems to have taken a different path, a different direction, in that he's become a little more political in terms of the world events that are going on today. He seems to have pushed himself more into the alternative energy field. He's really not pushing like he did before the extraterrestrial UFO issues. What's happened there? I think I'm pretty accurate in that assessment.
Well, I think we need to consider what Stephen Greer did was just tremendous work. I mean, over a period of, 10 years, he began with his Project Starlight in terms of assembling whistleblowers, high-level credible witnesses that had some experience with UFOs, ETs, and in the process sacrificed a very lucrative career as a medical professional. And over a 10-year period, I mean, he worked on this issue and then put together the 2001 Disclosure Project press interview. And then, of course, then we have September 11 in 2001.
Sure. Horrible timing, unfortunately.
That's it. I mean, we need to consider the timing here, that all of a sudden the situation shifted. And I think he probably just kind of like many of us, after 10 years of working in the field, maybe there's a little bit of burnout, but he probably felt that he did about as much as he could do, and it was probably time to, take a different approach, and maybe he felt that alternative energy would be something that he could produce some breakthroughs in. And after all, I mean, he's a family man. He's got four daughters that had to go through college. So,
sure.
I mean, there are those considerations. So I think for a number of reasons, he may have just kind of decided to kind of ease off a little with the disclosure work. But I know he's still involved in it. And very recently, he came out with a very powerful statement in support of one of his whistleblowers, Brigadier General Stephen Lufkin, who some criticism made of him in terms of his credibility, and Stephen Greer came forward. So he's still there and he's still watching things, but I think he's putting his priorities in the alternative energy, but he's still kind of keeping an eye on the disclosure.
Well, it seems that the good people like the Stephen Greers do get a little tired or maybe frustrated because disclosure really hasn't come as forward as they would like. Jacques Vallée, for example, has kind of like faded away, has gone to one or two conferences, I think, over the last year, but really doesn't want to get involved in the UFO field anymore. And it's a shame because he was one of the big ones.
Well, this is one of the things that a lot of people don't realize, is that when you have professionals coming forward, whether it's Vallée or whether it's Stephen Greer or others, and in my own case, I mean, I had to basically give up a career as well. And, I mean, what you do is you not only sacrifice a career, you sacrifice a salary, you sacrifice all the perks that go with it, and then what you get in return is you get a lot of kind of attacks, a lot of ridicule, people don't want to know you. And so there's a lot of sacrifices that go with that. And then this is one of the problems with doing this work is that professionals who take the gamble, who get involved in this field, don't have the support. There's the lack of institutional support existing. And that was one of the reasons why the Exopolitics Institute was created. I felt that one of the things we needed to do was to create an organization that would give institutional support to researchers who are wanting to do this work but are fearful of what will happen if they walk away from their careers, and also give support to those who have already done that. And that's very important, and that's hopefully something that many of the listeners will pay some attention to. The website, I know, is advertised on the Coast to Coast website, and they can have a look at the Exopolitics Institute and see if they can come in and support that, because that's really what's going to make a difference. If the researchers are supported, then they'll do good work. If they're not supported, they'll get burned out and they'll have to go and find other forms of remuneration.
I want to talk with you about two people, one Carol Rosen, the other David Jacobs. Carol Rosen being the spokesperson for the late Wernher von Braun, and then David Jacobs, the author, his book called The Threat, where he talks about the extraterrestrials. Let's talk about Carol Rosen first. Again, here we are with a credible person, spokesperson for the father of modern-day rocketry in this country, the German, Wernher von Braun, who, if it wasn't for his expertise, I don't think we ever would have gotten to the moon. She believes in extraterrestrials, doesn't she?
Well, that's correct, yes. She has had, whether it's her own experiences or whether it's what she actually viewed in terms of classified documents or what she was told by Wernher von Braun, she's formed the opinion that extraterrestrials are real. And probably more important in terms of this whole space weapons issue is that she believes that extraterrestrials are going to be kind of depicted as the next enemy, and that this was something Wernher von Braun was very concerned about as well, because he also was a firm believer in extraterrestrials, because he did have his own kind of experiences in Nazi Germany where that whole extraterrestrial phenomenon was taken much more seriously. And so Carol Rosen believes that based on what she has witnessed in various corporations that she's served in, that ETs are being depicted as the next threat, and that the space weapons issue is something that's being kind of put together so that it can be brought out against ETs, rolled out and presented to the public as a necessary weapon system to deal with ETs who are doing all sorts of nasty things. And this would, a lot of that would be concocted to justify space weapons.
This cattle mutilation phenomena is unbelievable because it's brutal. What's going on there, and can you tie that into the ETs?
Well, I mean, as you, I'm sure, are aware, many have tried to make that connection with the ETs. I mean, obviously, the cattle that are mutilated, I mean, they have biological material withdrawn from them, and using kind of laser-like surgery on their various body parts. So what that would suggest is that some groups are using advanced laser medical practices to extract the blood and vital organs of these animals. And when you kind of whittle away the possibilities, the final conclusion is that extraterrestrials are probably responsible. And, of course, there are a number of sightings often witnessed where cattle mutilations have occurred. So that would, again, kind of tend to suggest that ETs are involved in that. Certainly, that's what Corso believed, and a number of others.
Do you think they're taking the organs because they need to, or they're just testing the cattle for some kind of environmental problems or something?
Well, I think we need to consider that the extraterrestrials, wherever they've come from, have come to a planet which probably is very rich in terms of its biodiversity. I mean, it has a very great diversity of life, plant, fauna, and animal life. And so extraterrestrials that are involved would probably be extracting as much material as they can for various reasons, you know, whether it's something to do with genetic hybridization or whether it's just to improve their own food processing industries or whether it's to replenish supplies. But I think we can have a number of possibilities. And so what we're looking at with the cattle mutilations is the extraction of biological resources for probably uses that extraterrestrials have for it. And we can speculate about what those uses might be in terms of hybrid experiments and so forth, but certainly it does look as though some extraterrestrials are behind it, and this is part of the kind of resource extraction of biological resources that is occurring on the planet.
David Jacobs, this guy has done a great job, I think, with his theories, his analysis. I've watched him for years. I've read him. Your take on him?
Well, he's a very interesting researcher. I mean, he's put together some very important works in terms of analyzing the testimonies of abductees. And after analyzing hundreds of abductees, and he has done quite a lot of work with them, and he's done it using a variety of mechanisms or kind of qualitative tools like hypnosis, he has been able to analyze their testimonies and has come up with the theory, which is pretty alarming. For many who first hear of it, that the extraterrestrials are basically performing some kind of vast hybridization program where they're going to create some hybrid that would be biologically superior to Homo sapiens, who would presumably be the race that would replace humanity. And so he views that as a threat, and one of his books was actually titled The Threat. So certainly he's someone, I think like any social scientist, he works with the data, and I know many researchers are not very comfortable with his conclusions and criticize him for his kind of alarmist conclusions, but nevertheless, he's working with a database of people who have had things done to them through the abductions that are very disturbing, and he's kind of come up with a particular analysis which leads to his conclusion of ETs being a direct threat. Now, personally, I think his database is a little too narrow because he's only working with abductees and hasn't broadened it to look at other cases like contactees. I mean, there are some people who have had kind of fully conscious, benevolent interactions with extraterrestrials. And there's one Frenchman who I've got to work with closely recently who spent 10 days with extraterrestrials, and he has come back and has started to disseminate those experiences. And what he described were very beneficial, uplifting experiences. And his name is Eric Julian, and he's actually involved in the Exopolitics Institute as one of the directors there. So he's got some very fascinating information based on his contact experiences. And he's actually got a book that has been authored that describes the science of the extraterrestrials, and that I think is the first time that I'm aware of any contactee who has come back and, rather than writing a book about their experiences, actually writes about the science of the extraterrestrials. So he was given the kind of technological know-how by the extraterrestrials, and when he came back, he decided to write about that rather than his experiences. So that's another case which is very different to the pool or the data that David Jacobs works with.
What's the most compelling evidence to you, Michael, that would tell you beyond a shadow of a doubt that the ET situation is real?
Well, I would look at the whistleblower testimonies. I mean, I think when we look at people like Philip Corso, Robert Dean, Charles Hall, who have worked in the military. In the case of Corso and
the late Gordon Cooper, the astronaut,
also Cooper, Edgar Mitchell, I think, also has made some important statements. So we have a number of very credible people who have come forward and said that this is what they saw, this is what they experienced, these are the classified documents they had access to. I personally think that is kind of very important information, because people do not, you know, very credible people do not just make up stories at the end of their life for kind of fame and fortune. I mean, you know, there are far better things to do, you know, at the end of one's career than just make up some wild story about disseminating UFO technology while you're working in the Pentagon. I mean, this is not something that I imagine a person like Philip Corso would have done. Certainly not something I would imagine someone like Bob Dean would do, who did have a very successful career in the military, and then he worked for FEMA for 14 years after mm-hmm. that. A combined total of 41 years government service. And then at the end he starts talking, and then he comes out and says, well, this is what really happened. Now, a man with 41 years service in the military and government isn't just going to come out and make up some wild story and for 14 years keep saying that same story over and over again, being ridiculed and being attacked and criticized, but never changing his story. To me, that's pretty important evidence. And
yeah, that is gutsy. That's gutsy as well. Michael, let's stick around for another hour. Let's take some phone calls. You ready?
Yes, sir.
We'll be back in a moment. The lines are open on Coast to Coast AM.